Ness, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, a podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. In this week's podcast, we are going to begin a series of three podcasts about mindfulness and some of its effects that we see with college students and the way college students can bring mindfulness into their lives. I am actually not the interviewer on these podcasts. We have a bunch of students, as well as Rika, who you met in an earlier podcast conducting the interviews, and I'm just going to send it straight to them. So thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful, and Rika, you can take it this way.
So I'd like to welcome to our podcast here at NYU, Callie Grainsvolt, who has served the Shinyoan members at the White Plains New York Temple and at the Shinyo Center in Manhattan over the past decade. He assists in officiating at traditional esoteric Shinyo Buddhist rituals and acts as a spiritual guide for Shinyo session meditation. In addition, Calvi is the lead meditation guide at the Secular Shinyo Center for Meditation and Well-Being in Manhattan. He has led meditation events in Bryant Park, CUNY here at NYU, for the Reciprocity Foundation, the Yale Club, and Mass Bliss, and has participated in psychology and education conferences at Columbia and Pace Universities. Calvi has also appeared on PBS Religion and Ethics Newsweekly. So I want to welcome Calvi here today. He's one of our panelists for our big event that occurred on April 5th here at NYU for Mindful NYU called Buddhism Now, which was focusing on the next generation of teachers. So welcome, Calvi.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I just thought we'd start out with you just sharing with our audience, with our listeners, a little bit about your background, how you came to the practice, and what's coming up for you in your own practice maybe these days.
Thank you, for the opportunity to share that. I sort of came to Buddhism in a very peculiar way, I guess. It was really through sophomore English class that I got interested in a lot of the transcendentalist authors. And coming from a biracial background, my own sense of identity really was binary in a sense. So half Japanese, half European in background, grown up here in New York City. And so that always put a kind of sort of a motivator to get a sense of who I am. So the more that I read these authors, I really want to explore sort of this inner state, regardless of what I look like and what backgrounds I come from in a genetic sense. Mm. And I guess sort of fast forward, starting around the age of 16, I began going to a Buddhist practice. I felt very welcomed. I never had to give up anything that was a part of my identity. And it actually accepted the practices I'd done before that were a part of my Judeo-Christian background. So having gone to churches, gone to Baha'i and different faith practice centers. So at least it sort of gave me a place where I felt I could explore something that I needed to know. And I guess I haven't looked back.
So it was one of those things where you felt like in the sort of general society of growing up in a place as multicultural as New York, that you still felt like you had to choose and compartmentalize yourself in ways outside of the practice. And then you found this, which allowed you to sort of come in more holistically. Am I getting that right?
I think so. And I think, especially growing up in public schools, mm-hmm. came from a very standardized testing background. A lot of forms to ask, what is your ethnicity? Who are you? Mm-hmm. And I was always tempted to check. What do I check? Pacific, Asian, Islander? Mm-hmm. Certainly didn't identify with that. Mm-hmm. My white, Caucasian. And I think at one point when I got a little bit more gutsy, maybe in high school, I checked other and I wrote human being. Mm-hmm. And I felt, that's what I need to explore, my humanness and what that means. So that really drew me to a spiritual pursuit. I felt that was a harvest for me to slowly reap in getting to know who I am and how I fit in this multicultural world of labels.
Mm. And what did you find out?
So the jury's still out on that.
Yeah.
But I think the spiritual practice and Buddhism in particular really sort of encouraged me to look at what is positive about me, what do I bring and what makes me unique. Mm. And I feel like that positive sort of positivity really is something that I didn't have growing up. And having been bullied for many years. I'm sorry, this is turning into a therapy
session.
Yeah,
yes.
But it really does do a number on your mental health.
Sure.
And you start to look at yourself in certain ways. So I felt like this was a real turning point where I could think about, so what is positive about me? What is beautiful? And finding that myself then gave me the chance to see that in other people too.
Mm.
It changed the narrative, the script that was kind of my undercurrent, if you will.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people come to the practice from that place looking for acceptance, looking for a place to deal with and manage pain too, right?
Right.
So I think it's quite natural.
Yes.
So tell me how it was that you came to be at Shinyuan.
So I never really had any interest in exploring my Japanese side.
Mm.
And at some point, my Caucasian dad, who was always the more interested party in the family in Eastern philosophies and religions, he had met somebody who was Japanese. He introduced that person to my mother. And suddenly a chanting book appeared next to my bedside one day. My mom had put it there, and I was told that we're going to go check this place out. And I said, no, we're not. Saturday is my time off.
Wow.
It's very precious.
Yeah.
But that was still the time when I was trying to be open to new things, and books were a very powerful thing. Ralph Waldo Emerson, sophomore literature. So I thought, why don't I just take a look at this chanting book that has some Sanskrit, has some Japanese, and things that are supposed to be sacred and good.
Mm.
And then visiting the temple, I just sort of, more than having thought it was right, I trusted my feeling, and I felt very accepted. And I felt like this could be a kind of a laboratory where I can indeed explore who I am. And that's only matured over time. There have been more people that I've met, more experiences that I would have never expected would have come up.
Mm.
And that stretching and growing process has taught me a lot about, you know, the sort of attitude to have and trying to apply that spiritual mindset with whatever life kind of throws our way.
And so you actually are now what is the title am I getting? I know it's always like hard to translate and things like that, but because you now work for Shinyo, but you're also trained in lineage, yes?
Right,
yeah.
Right. I like to say I just work there.
Yeah.
But it is in a clergy role.
Mm.
And that started about 16 years ago when I was 24.
Mm.
It was a time when I kind of was wrestling between what I thought I wanted to have as an image.
Mm.
I had a choice to either become a second lieutenant in the United States Army as a medical officer. I had been in the National Guard to pay for my school.
Mm.
And financially, even appearance-wise, that gold bar on the shoulder really spoke to certain parts of me.
Mm.
And it was at that point that I wrestled with deciding to want to maybe heal or do something that can help the world, maybe not as an army nutritionist, but perhaps as a Buddhist in a fuller sense.
Mm. And has it been a good decision?
it certainly kind of challenged my humility.
Mm.
So I certainly did not get a gold bar when I began. I started by cleaning toilets.
Mm.
and doing a lot of things that were kind of taught me about what my image of myself was. I spent the first 10 years focused almost totally on taking care of the grounds of the temple.
Was this
the building.
Here or in Japan?
3 months I spent in Japan.
Mm.
Doing that. And then after I left my life there, doing this almost exclusively for our meditation centers and our 5-acre temple in White Plains.
Mm.
So through that, there was a lot of kind of background things that I learned. And attention didn't really come to me until something broke down. Air conditioning broke down. The power went out. And it was a very enlightening experience. And then as time has moved on, I've had more opportunities to do interfaith work and to serve at the UN in different capacities and certainly to be a part of something as special as what NYU has put together with Buddhism now.
So around the interfaith, because we have multiple segments of the office, and one of them is definitely our Many Institute, which focuses on interfaith work. Tell me what it has been sort of gratifying to you about that particular part of what you do.
I think just connecting with people, it's becoming a lost art form.
Mm-hmm.
And I think technology, when I think back, email was just becoming big. I was using a modem that screeched and burred. That's a dinosaur now. It's way in the past.
Right.
But I think as connectivity changes, learning how to have a phone call with someone to discuss a deep, profound topic, just to meet face-to-face, these are things that are, I think, slowly ebbing away from the skill set of people. And myself included. I put myself in that boat, too.
Mm.
So it really forces that human connection, which you just can't ever cultivate unless you do it again and again and again. It gives me hope that there are people in this world who care, and they apply that care from different angles, different perspectives, but always looking for how we can sort of harness that collective care. I mean, that restores my hope that this is important work and we really can change the future in some small way.
Yeah, no, it's really beautiful. Along those lines around like sort of the technology and that element, that piece, which is something that definitely is a modern issue for people in the practice or young people coming into either Buddhist practice or mindfulness practice, looking for some sort of a almost escape, but also feeling a little addicted and all that kind
right.
of stuff. What are you seeing in your own community of people coming through or seeking your help, advice, guidance around technology and what they're experiencing around it?
So there's no doubt they're affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
I have at least more people than I can count on two hands that get texts, they get messages from their bosses on the weekends. And it creates anxiety. I mean, there's a physiological response that's highly unpleasant. And I think, unfortunately, that connectivity is sort of invading certain parts of our days and weeks that maybe we hold a little more sacred when we need that time to recharge. So I am seeing that stress response, and I'm seeing people coming through the doors for meditation, for some sort of spiritual retreat, because they do feel like they need to escape. And I think one of the biggest challenges then is not to feel comfortable and just retreating, but then to figure out, well, okay, how can I retreat long enough to figure out how I want to respond rather than react to the people in the world around. And so learning how to really kind of re-engage with society and really to see the world as the monastery. It's not to retreat to some faraway monastery for a prolonged time, but then to come back and see everyone, every place that you're in, as that place of practice. And
not easy stuff.
And yes.
And so in terms of like just how people can do that, what is your advice? What is your guidance around living in the world as it is? Because that's part of the practice too, right? Is the acceptance of this is the world we're in now.
Right.
But how we manage it to be in that world is really the place of the practice, right? So
right.
What is it that you offer the people coming to you with these stressors?
I really believe in little micro victories, meaning to take just small moments of the day, whether it's the moment when you're standing and the train doors are about to open. If we can transform that time to, you know, sort of step back and let people out. I know it sounds maybe so almost too simple, but I feel like these are little micro victories where we start to build this kind of inner narrative that shows us we can do this in everyday life, whether it's washing the dishes, small moments of care, of warmth, and sort of giving that to other people. We're giving something to ourselves. And I think in small ways, it begins to change the ecosystem that we all share in this city and whatever environment that we're in.
So I'm wondering along those lines, because it sounds like compassion practice in a lot of ways too, right? So making room for compassionate living in a city that can be or feel very not compassionate. So I wonder also like what it is around how to, because I think a lot of people think that mindfulness practice, especially the compassion component, the loving kindness component, is kind of passive. And this means you're supposed to be like, you know, like lying on the floor, letting everybody walk all over you,
right.
Which is also not a very New York thing, right?
No, it's not.
So how do you sort of balance the two, or what do you tell people who are just like, oh, but this are just like people sitting in a room meditating and not caring about anybody else, but also just letting people walk all over them?
Right. No, I think we can't survive in New York City or in any place if we're letting people walk all over us.
Mm-hmm.
I think an action can look the same on the outside, but the intention, where it comes from, that is a really powerful thing. So, and it translates into very subtle ways. So even if you have to say something that may not be pleasant, there's a way that you can say it, and there's an intention you can have when you're saying it,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know if there's some scientific measure that you can hook something up and tell, see a perceivable difference,
mm-hmm.
but I do believe that that little nuance does find its way into the other person's heart, and it does have the power to create little micro moments of change and real transformation.
And where would you say intention has a place in social media? Because a lot of our young people are engaging a lot in that way,
right?
Which can also be difficult around compassion practice or loving kindness.
Absolutely.
Like it challenges that.
Right.
So what kind of advice would you give our college students around that?
I just did a symposium at Columbia University for their 33rd Winter Roundtable discussion, and I presented with a professor from Columbia and one from Pace.
Mm-hmm.
And the one from Pace actually just did a study on texting, and she created an app that was supposed to generate more warmth and sort of kindness or mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really surprised to see that there were ways where somehow the app was designed within 6 minutes to sort of give you a chance to reflect on how you want to respond. I haven't seen the app, so I'm sorry, I'm not really doing it justice.
No,
but
is it like a pause? It creates a pause somehow? Or?
There was something in the app that was meditative, that was meant to give you a restorative pause to think about how you want to respond. And somehow it came about because it seemed like 6 minutes was this average amount of time that came up between texts. I don't ask me. I didn't do the research.
No, that's fine. That's interesting.
But what was amazing to see was there would be a text, for example, from a daughter to her mom saying, "Mom, you're always late. I hate it when you do this." After she had gone through this using the app and going through the study, the message transformed into, "I'm starting to feel overwhelmed. I'm not happy that you're late." And something changed in how they were knowing themselves and articulating that to the world. It was a very subtle thing. It still had a certain flavor of frustration, but it was a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so surprised to see that laid out in this presentation of text messages.
It's fascinating. I wonder, like, what your thoughts on are around mindfulness practices or meditation or these Buddhist principles and honesty and sort of transparency, vulnerability, because I also know as young people, a lot of our students, they're scared to be vulnerable and open. There's a lot of risk there. So their communication styles are based on that in a lot of ways. So I'm wondering what you can say about the practice that sort of lends itself to being able to do that.
Mm.
And also feel like they're not going to fall apart.
Right. I mean, I do feel we all wear some kind of invisible, an invisible suit of armor.
Mm.
And we keep putting it, sort of packing it on more and more. Being able to take that off actually takes a lot of strength. And to feel a certain strength in being who we are, you know, without that sort of protective barrier where we create distance or we try to put a certain image of who we are out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a quick answer for that. I really do think it's one of the merits of a cumulative practice, whether it's spiritual, whether it's a secular meditative practice.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think the spiritual aspect gives a lot of breadth to how we can take that armor off and actually tap into this inner resilience and strength that comes with doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be as an embodied practice, almost wearing our genuineness and our intention to really discover who we are. There are no practice runs in this world. There are no there are no real do-overs. So really learning to kind of go with the flow in each situation, tapping into those inner strengths, I feel like as a cumulative practice, we do discover another version of ourselves that that we can't find in any other way. And so in the same way that we feel the clothes that we're wearing on the back, to feel our meditative state, not just as a theoretical or as a mental thing, but to feel it as a whole body way, I feel like that's the key to sort of creating that whole body confidence to really be who we are. It's so hard.
it's not an easy thing. And obviously time and age also helps,
yes,
for sure. But,
for sure.
We have a lot of wonderful young people in our program who are brave enough to start,
yes,
the process now, which is,
yes,
wonderful. And I want to speak a little bit about that, given some of the things we touched upon like around social media and technology and disconnection, but connection through media versus in-person stuff. I wonder if you can speak a little bit about Sangha or community, or, you know, ways in which we practice with others,
right,
versus our individual practice,
right,
and how those things differ.
Right. So Sangha and community is a really interesting topic because this is a very individualistic society.
Yeah.
And I feel like America especially has that real pioneer spirit. And to sort of find a balance between who we are as that as our own pioneer, but also finding our group identity too. There's so much that comes out when we open the doors and really connect with other people. I think one of the central practices of giving, or dana paramita in Buddhism, it requires another person. You know, to give something requires a person to receive. And without having gratitude for that person being there to receive your sincerity, that practice cannot be done. And so really having a sangha and seeing the world as our monastery, even our coworkers, the fellow students, classmates, just the people around us in some way, shape, or form as our kind of sounding board, it is like living in a world of mirrors where we can see ourselves and how other people respond to us. So I can't say enough about how important it is to never retreat fully from that connection, and to really see the value of discovering who we are in that group context. And perhaps that will then help us become a better pioneer when we are cultivating our path on our own, because we'll have seen things about ourselves that we couldn't necessarily find just in sort of self-reflection alone.
Yeah, those are good points. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of community, so for those listening, come and practice with us. That'll be my little selling point for our community sits. And also finding a place like Shinyo Meditation and Wellbeing Center, right? So, or
sure.
Shinyo Center for Meditation and Wellbeing.
It is a mouthful.
Yeah.
I promise we don't bite.
So if I was a young person, a college age student who wanted to check it out, what would I do? Would I just come to the center? Would I...
Yeah, you would take one foot, put it in front of the other, and do it again and again until you get to 36th Street between 5th and 6th on the ground floor. And yeah, just come in and we'd be happy to see any one of you there.
Great. So I want to thank Calvi. We'll be posting up this and also videos of the April 5th event soon. So people should completely check it out and for sure go visit him at the Shinyo Center on 36th Street. Again, thank you so much. And
thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Monty Faithful. Special thanks to Reka for being an awesome office mate and for conducting the interview, to Calvi for joining, and to all of you for listening. Thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We look forward to having you back for next week's episode.